You've tuned in to Columbia Calling, your first stop for everything you want to know about Columbia. How and where to invest, where to visit. From the Pacific to the Caribbean, the Andes Mountains to the Amazon jungle, Columbia has a slice of everything. Shooting from the hip, answering the questions that need answering. Here's your host, the journalist and hotelier Richard McCall, shedding some light on the fashionable South American destination of Colombia.
It's that time of the week again, folks. It's me, your host, Richard McCall, here in Bogota, Colombia. This is episode 265 of the Colombia Calling podcast. Thank you again to all of you out there who continue to download and stream the Colombia Calling podcast. Our numbers continue to increase, and you have my eternal gratitude for this. If you ever find yourself in Colombia, Bogota, or even Mompox, look me up for a coffee, because I do owe you it. This episode, it's a great episode that we've got in the pipeline. We get academic and researcher Yana Shevkirova on the line from London. She's she was brought up in Bulgaria, but she's been living in London for the last, the last 7 years. She's an expert in peace and conflict studies and intelligence and international security. We'll be asking, of course, about these courses, the BA and the MA that she pursued at King's College, and of course be putting it all into the context of Colombia. She has, of course, traveled to Colombia and studied Colombia, so therefore her knowledge is applied to these situations. We'll be discussing dehumanization, stigma, and grievances in the context of the Colombian conflict. This follows on nicely to last week's interview with Rachel Schmidt in episode 264, talking about the demobilization of the AUC paramilitaries. Of course, that was incredibly popular, almost as popular as Rachel's previous appearance on Colombia Calling, where episode 251, where she talked about the demobilization of the FARC guerrillas. So, you know, be sure to check those out if you haven't already. Very effective interviews on the Colombia Calling podcast, and retaining the importance of what we do here. I mean, I'm not trying to be pretentious, but we try and tell a little bit more about Colombia than is there in the mainstream media. We're trying to go beyond a little bit the headlines and, you know, fulfill something that is close to me as a journalist, the commitment to telling and investigating just a little bit more. So thank you for this. It's always a real pleasure. And I know that people now, they've been mentioning it on Twitter and Facebook and emails, that the segment with the director of Columbia Reports, Adrian Alsema, is very popular, especially to those who don't or can't follow the news all the time about Colombia, and they find this to be one of the most effective ways of keeping themselves updated about what is going on in our wonderful country. And as I say every week, peaks and troughs, but this is a really great place to live when you settle down and have you know the path that you want to take, and you dedicate your life to it. It's a wonderful place to live, and there's nowhere else, I don't know, and Colombians really do embrace you if you are prepared to put your all in to their country, your 2 cents. So without further ado, I'll take a short break, and the next person you'll hear will be Adrian Alsema giving us the lowdown of last week's news in Colombia, and keeping us informed from Colombia Reports. Of course, Adrian is the director of this fascinating and incredibly important website based in Medellin. Do check it out. That's www.ColombiaReports.com, the most up-to-date news outlet in English about Colombia and based here in Colombia. So don't go away. We'll be back. And then after that, we'll be talking to Yana Shevkirova of the website rebelaffairs.com, Rebel Affairs. And you'll remember her article about Bogota, written on December 31st, a very insightful article, very important article that was greatly appreciated by those of us living here in Bogota, someone who came to the city and saw behind the superficial nature of just the graffiti tours, you know, the message of the graffiti and the message of the stratification in the city and in the country. So that's me signing off for right now. Don't go away. We'll be right back after Adrian Alsamer has given us the news. Thank you again. Bye-bye.
My name is Adrian Alsma, and this is the news for Colombia Calling for March 19, 2019. President Iván Duque's decision to return a bill to Congress that defines the powers of the country's war crimes tribunal triggered a constitutional crisis. The president objected to articles that had already been adopted by the Constitutional Court, making it uncertain whether Congress is legally allowed to make changes. Furthermore, fears are that the controversial decision will lead to the mass rearmament of demobilized FARC guerrillas, who demobilized in 2016. With the exception of the U.S. government, the international community has stepped up to defend the War Crimes Tribunal. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres urged Colombia's foreign minister, Carlos Holmes Trujillo, to secure the ratification of the tribunal's statutory law as soon as possible. Key trade partners from Europe, including Spain and the United Kingdom, reiterated their support for the War Crimes Tribunal. The transitional justice system is expected to continue its investigation into war crimes unless Congress amends the Constitution. Colombia's Constitutional Court surprisingly banned the extradition of alleged war criminals. The move is a major blow for Duque and U.S. Ambassador Kevin Whitaker, who claimed that the practice is an important tool to fight drug trafficking. But according to the court, the extradition of alleged war criminals violates the right of victims who are unable to receive justice while their alleged victimizers are abroad. Venezuelan opposition supporters used Colombia to prepare an assassination attack against President Nicolas Maduro, they told American television network CNN. The failed drone attack in April last year was carried out without the knowledge of Colombian authorities, according to the attackers, who said to be working with rogue elements within the Venezuelan military. Officials from Washington met with the opposition bombers after the attack, they said, but were not involved in the planning of new attacks. Some 15,000 members of indigenous groups from southwest Colombia blocked the Pan-American highway that connects the center of the country to Ecuador, spurring violent clashes with the police. The groups demand an end to government neglect and want to meet with President Duque to talk about ongoing violence and alleged government failures to keep promises made with ethnic minorities. Duque said on Saturday he would not talk to the indigenous and claimed he is not bound to any agreement made by previous governments. Far-right group Águilas Negras, which supports Duque and his Democratic Center Party, threatened to assassinate all indigenous leaders in Cauca where the protests are taking place. The group offered financial rewards ranging from $1,600 for every dead indigenous governor to $350 for every participant in the protest. That's the end of this week's news bulletin. Now back to Colombia Calling with Richard McCall.
Hello, folks. This is Colombia Calling. Thank you to Adrian Alsamer, for his update from Colombia Reports. He's the director of Colombia Reports, the widest read website in English about Colombia, I believe, the world over. I wouldn't be at all surprised if that isn't true. But anyway, this is episode 265 of the Colombia Calling podcast. And as I mentioned in the first opening segment, we're talking to Yana Shevkirova. She's a Londoner, but with roots and history in Bulgaria and further east. But she can tell us all about that. The reason I've got her on, and a lot of you who are regular listeners of the Colombia Calling podcast will have read a blog called Rebel Affairs, that's rebelaffairs.com. On December 31st, she wrote a great blog about Bogota and vacillations and so on and so forth. And we've been in touch, you know, here and there. She's a Colombiaphile, really, and her background is in peace and conflict studies. And she has an MA in intelligence and international security. So before I get carried away in these topics, it's let me introduce Jana and say thank you very much for coming on the Columbia Calling podcast and taking time out of your busy days to talk to us a little bit about your studies and about Colombia.
Oh, no, thank you. It's a pleasure. And Colombiaphile is a really good description of how I feel. And yes, absolutely. That's an absolutely brilliant introduction.
Thank you so much. Now, Jana, tell us a little bit. I mean, you grew up in Bulgaria and then you ended up in London studying all of these incredibly highbrow courses and so on, I guess, at King's College, because that's the place that does all of these very fascinating courses. Tell us a little bit about where your interest in Colombia came from, I guess you study Colombia as a case study in peace and conflict and so on.
Not at all, actually.
Wow.
It was a twist. It was a plot twist. So I started with a BA in peace and conflict studies, and I had wonderful professors, and they really challenged with different questions that really kind of, well, they were groundbreaking in a way. So challenging some rigid views. And as I was growing up, I had these black and white views of what is wrong and what is right and, you know, everything about politics. And I was very passionate about it. And then I did my bachelor's and I had a really great professor for one of the courses. And he said, you know, there's always a context to things. And he started exploring complex conflicts you know, the civil wars and how intricate they are. And I got really interested in this. And I thought, yeah, it's really difficult to tell who's right and wrong in these moments. And I developed this interest in Middle East specifically. And further down the line, decided to pursue master's, but I only had one master's in mind. And I said, if I do master's at all, it will be intelligence. And only King's College and another university in Wales do that sort of degree, and everything else is in the US. And I said, I'll apply for intelligence. If it works, if they accept me, that will be it. Otherwise, we'll see what happens. They accepted me. And I was really keen to explore the world of spying, espionage. And that's what it's all about. Not James Bond type of stuff, but I don't know if you've read John le Carré.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he's a wonderful author. And it's very similar. So, you know, Cold War politics, espionage from that time, but also currently how intelligence services and how security works, especially externally abroad. Obviously, it linked very well into my interest in the Middle East. And I was thinking, I want to become a civil servant. And so I thought, this is it. I'll graduate. I'll join SIS, which is the Foreign Intelligence Service here. And this will be my path in life. As it turns out, it's not as easy. You need to have lived here for many, many years. You need to speak fluent Arabic, which was part of what I was doing. But there were some obstacles, bureaucratic obstacles. And I was thinking, what shall I do next? If it's not civil service, and it was very bureaucratic, and it was very difficult to get into it. And I did decide that I'd like to explore research. As a side hustle to my current job, I decided to kind of to create this website, Rebel Affairs, just explore things that I'm really passionate about, topics that linked into my previous research that I've done on dehumanization, as we will discuss further down the line, but also to explore different countries, because the time was not quite right to move into the Middle East. It was, you know, when ISIS were there, really at their height, and I decided, so it's not for someone as young as an experienced as me, to move, whether as a researcher or civil servant, into the Middle East. So I thought I'll take another slightly easier, and that is not to, you know, to minimize what's happening, but slightly easier, less complex example of a conflict. Go there, explore, get some experience and see how things go. Little did I know that I'd actually very much fall in love with Colombia. And as the more I read about it, the more I explored Latin America in general and far back into the history, and examples from Colombia, from Venezuela, even Central America, I really, really had this idea that maybe it's all linked. The conflicts that I would be able to explore in the Middle East, they're the same conflicts in Latin America, in Central America, everywhere, really, because everything comes all the way down to the individual, to grievances, to psychological conditioning in a way. So, yeah, it's such a huge topic that I thought it doesn't matter where I start. It's just about getting experience.
That's pretty incredible, actually, because I was going to say, you know, how do you link the Middle East to Colombia without sort of talking about Hezbollah in Venezuela and then the bombing in Argentina. But you changed tack, let's say, in the pathway that you'd chosen, and it brought you to Colombia and this similarities that you see as an expert in these fields. This follows on very nicely from last week's episode, in fact, about the paramilitaries and with Rachel Schmidt talking about their demobilization. But the individual and grievances, I can see this intensely focused here in Colombia. I mean, when you think about the grievances not only people have towards the guerrillas, towards the paramilitaries, towards each other, this country may actually be one of the most, one of the focal points and epicenters of grievances, because they just continue and there's so much all the time, especially in this sort of global polarization that's taking place. So you then came over to Colombia, I guess it's twice last year, or is it once last year and once this year already, to follow up on your own investigations?
Yes, very much so. First time I visited was to get a sense if that sort of environment would be okay for me to work in, and how I can develop contacts. And I loved it. I loved it from the very beginning. Just the first day when I landed, and I thought, wow, okay. I had some weird connection, and I know it might sound a bit strange, but I just felt a connection with the place. And I decided to just talk to various people. So I spoke to journalists, to people from the businesses, private sector, just friends that I had in mind to reach out to. I have developed quite a few friends in there who work on human rights as well. And I just, all the people I spoke to kept saying how, yes, there's a peace agreement, but there's this like bubbling of intensity on the, you know, on this below the surface, and it's a very interesting thing. And yes, it very much links to what you were saying about the grievances, and it runs so deep. It was generations of people who have lived in conflict, and it's very interesting to explore.
I think that there's something that we should pick up there. As you said, this generations here in Colombia who've lived or survived or suffered through this long-running conflict. And this is one of the things I end up saying to so many Colombians when they talk to me about the inadequacies of the peace deal and always on. I think there's this feeling of urgency that they want that the peace deal to have already, worked and completed the issues that here on the table in Colombia, that we want to turn over the page, move on. Yes, the peace bill's been done, and there's inadequacies. But I say to them, we have to say, is it, look at any peace deal anywhere in the world, there's going to be inadequacies and there's going to be flaws in it, but we've got to work with what there is. But I guess there's this frustration after so long, and then of course people, for good reason, being unable to let go of certain grievances. So, I mean, in your experience around Colombia, would you say that rings true?
Yes, but I think there are two points to it. So, yes, of course, it will never be perfect. You'll never have any sort of peace agreement that will be fully comprehensive. But this one comes quite close to it, to be honest, from what I know, you know, and having explored different conflicts and different peace processes, I think this is fine. And it's actually brilliant that they actually reached that point. That is impressive on its own. But the implementation of it, that is another issue. And I think that, you know, obviously it's very political as well. It depends on the government. And, you know, now you have Iván Duque, completely separate example from Santos. But it's very different. So the implementation of the peace agreement itself will be even more important, I think, simply because I've heard from contacts that I've spoken with as well, that it's one thing on paper, and then it develops quite differently for people, especially for former rebels on the ground. And obviously now, I think, especially with the current government, there will be this moment of suffocating the peace agreement in a way. I'd like to choose my words carefully, but I don't think that they will provide enough funding if that's the way for them to go, because obviously they disapprove of some parts of it. And I think they might just stop the funding for certain aspects, or, you know, as the issue now with HIP is, with the legislation as well. I think there will be several issues, and especially and most importantly, it will be very different from what is on paper as it is implemented in the lives of former rebels. So let's say the financial support that they get to reintegrate into society, to start their own businesses. Even I've heard several cases of things being said that there's a lot of support by the government, there's a lot of support by NGOs, but in fact, in a way, they're not allowed to really proceed with their own ideas, their own businesses. And obviously also, there's not enough support in terms of education and kind of sustainability of what they do.
Yeah, I suppose institutional issues here that are at play. Like you said, the suffocating. I feel that the government, to appease international, let's say the international community, will do the absolute minimum, sort of drip the funding or drip their support towards the project. It is worrying because even The Economist this week has come out with things like, you know, the man who's finishing off Colombia's peace process. I mean, that's The Economist. That's pretty serious stuff if they say it. But we've talked about Greece. So go on.
So I was going to say, yes, very true, indeed. And also it's a huge sign of their lack of commitment, really, which how does someone who has been fighting for the FARC, let's say, would see this? You know, there's no commitment from the government. There's a lot of stigma from the outside, from society. How would those people who have suffered so much trauma, let aside the issue that they might, you know, how they're seen as evil or not, it doesn't matter, but how does someone who has gone through war, through conflict, has suffered so much trauma, would reintegrate into society if that society doesn't help them, or if the government doesn't help? And these are serious issues to explore. And it's always not just the practical side of things, but also it's the values and the emotional support that those people need to see in place so that they can proceed with life normally.
Definitely. And of course, this brings us quite nicely to the issues when we talk about the reintegration, the reincorporation. Of course, the language is very, very, you've got to be very careful with the language. but the question of the trauma, and of course, the trauma leading to this, we can talk about the society's trauma in Colombia, but leading to this overwhelming dehumanization, which is a topic that you are very keen to explore.
Very much so, and it is underexplored, really. I don't know anyone, actually, so far. I've read quite a lot on the topic, and I have separate interests in psychology and psychoanalysis. And when I was doing my master's degree, I had this year-long project to research on a specific topic. And I discovered that it hasn't been explored, the dehumanization in the sense of conflict, but in a sense of, you know, in a complex conflict. So there's a little bit of academic work around dehumanization during war, specifically as it relates to battlefield. So it is very well known, but armies tend to train their soldiers to kill. And there are several books that say there's one very specific acts of war that Richard Holmes in late 1980s he wrote. And it's all about how, the army conditions psychologically the soldier to kill. And obviously that kind of enables them to be effective on the battlefield. And it's absolutely normal. And it's very effective in a conflict where you have, the clear enemy, where you can, as they like to say, exterminate the enemy and the war is over. You win over them, you kill enough, the state gives up. This is not the case in conflicts such as the one in Colombia or such as some in the Middle East. Dehumanization has really expanded. If you look at some of the psychoanalysis literature, you can see that dehumanization can relate in many ways. It can happen within groups. So certain groups becoming very aggressive towards other groups just on the basis of grievances. And this is what Rachel was exploring in the last episode. Or you can have also individuals kind of trying to dehumanizing the other simply because they feel that they are not heard or, basic needs are not met, which is something that, for example, Maslow explores in psychoanalysis as well. So there are so many layers to explore in a complex conflict. And I think it's something very applicable in the Colombian context as well.
Well, one of the things that most strikes me is obviously the peacemaker, let's say, the Nobel Prize winner, President Santos, former president, even with all of his positive language in the last five years, and all of the work for longer than 5 years, obviously. When he was the Minister for Defense under Alvaro Uribe, former president, when they found the tunnels that the FARC had been using, much like the Vietnamese tunnels in Kuchi, but when they found these tunnels that the FARC had been using, and he went down and did the photo op, and of course he said, we've got them bombed, and they're like rats in the tunnels. They're like rats who are hiding down there, who are having their issues. So even he has been guilty of such things. Of course, he changed his language very, very quickly as soon as he became president, because he made the issue to work onto the peace deals and so on. But this language needs to be changed. And I don't think that Duque is in any position to do so.
No, not at all. But it's not just the language. So the language is one side of it. It's also the mentality. So if the attitude in their mind doesn't change, and that is also on a collective level, then the language will never, change, will never follow suit either. But the language is very much a point, because the classical definition of dehumanization is just looking at someone and saying they're subhuman. So you would see, if you read some articles, let's say, on about interviews of drone operators who refer to their targets, as they say, they never refer to them as people. They refer to them as targets or as ants. And there was a fantastic interview in The Guardian a few years ago of two drone operators saying that they basically had to dehumanize people on the ground and refer to them as ants due to kind of exterminate. So that is very similar, using analogies with animals, or just really devaluating those people, which actually allows this sort of treatment. It allows dehumanizing them. It allows saying that they are evil and there is no winning over them. They just need to be exterminated, which is, yes, indeed, it's a very dangerous language to use, especially if you're trying to create peace. Mm.
I'm going to change the topic a little bit, mm-hmm. and I'm sorry for jumping this way. As someone who knows a lot about the intelligence and international security, let's say, field, Of course, I want to talk a little bit about Venezuela. You know, we can't avoid it at the moment. It's the hot topic in this region. And of course, Colombia being a, you know, the neighbor, and Brazil. From your perspective in this field, how do you feel that the information is being collated and what we are seeing in the news? I mean, do we, as someone, again, you've studied the academics, and of course your interests are focused in this. There must be more going on behind the scenes, let's say international back channels. What would you say about this? I'm floundering.
No, I very much agree. I think a lot of it is just politics. So, to what extent they collect intelligence is slightly different from the matter of politics. I think there's a lot of pressure. So let's say from the US for some sort of action. I think it's more military action that they're keen on. And there's obviously, you know, Russia would be very interested in the region and supporting Maduro. When it comes to intelligence collection, there's plenty of opportunities, whether that will be, you know, from ranks in the military, people who are very, very much, you know, disappointed with what is going on, disillusioned, but they just don't want to abandon them. They don't want to escape the country. Some of them have fled already, obviously, but others might be able to pass on information of what is actually going on, which is very helpful for intelligence agencies. I am not very familiar as to how Colombian intelligence would operate and whether they would focus on human intelligence. That is also usually information that's not very readily available, naturally so. I would assume that they have people on the ground within the military ranks, highly likely. And another, obviously, a great opportunity to explore is, you know, people who are going to fight there, you know, people who flee the country and then just, you know, give away information readily to either the Colombians or depending on where they would go. I think that's a very fertile environment to collect intelligence. And you can also collect intelligence from open source. So, you know, what Maduro is trying to show, the way militaries, you know, operate right now, you can see things, you can find things online. It's a huge field to explore, especially now. There are many people who are experts in this, and I think there's a lot of information to get from this way as well, you know, from those sorts of sources that are open for anyone, really.
Definitely. And I mean, I find it just a very fascinating situation when you talk about the US discussing their need to sort of Monroe Doctrine and their need to have more influence in the region. And how many posts in Latin America has the Trump government failed to fill already at this time? And of course, how long have Russia and China been involved in Venezuela, you know, to increase their influence in the region? I mean, the two sides are so starkly opposite to one another in terms of their involvement. I just find it so very interesting that we're not discussing more profoundly. I you know, there's some very good reports coming out from some very good journalists, and of course then it's the more the human interest and the shock articles that come out, the tragedies of people dying in hospitals because of the lack of electricity. But behind this there are deeper stories. And I would like someone to be at the let's say the power plant in the southeast to see if Russian engineers were arriving or Chinese engineers. You know, is it out of the question to think this?
No. You never know. That's the thing. Yeah. It's such a deep story behind every conflict like this. And, you know, you never know, is this all about politics? Is it about showing off? Is it influence? Is it just the oil? I think there's just a lot of power play dynamics in there. Yes, Chinese, Russians, and US have a lot there to win and to lose. I think Maduro is just, you know, just the government du jour. There would have been somebody else, and the same thing would be playing out. And it's the people who suffer. That is the most terrifying aspect. It's just the people who, you know, who have to endure this trauma. And it's just fascinating how Venezuela has transformed, you know, how it was a few years ago and how it is now. And I'm not quite sure if anybody would have expected this.
No, to move so dystopian in its outlook. But as we sort of talk about this, and we talk about, as you say, the dehumanization, the peace accords, I know another issue that you're very interested in is you've seen and you've written about an opportunity for, let's say, the private sector to move in and help influencing issues in post-conflict situations.
Yes, and I'm not quite sure to what extent this is some sort of an utopian idea, because it just came across my mind. And I think if the government is not doing anything, or at least it's kind of a very neutral, and especially now, you know, in Colombian sense, I think there's a lot of opportunity for the private sector. And if the government would like to pick up, or the international community would love to get involved, that's fine. That will be amazing. Best case scenario, but even, you know, now what they have, it will be great to give chance to former rebels to reintegrate back into society, to have a normal life, to get more skills, and I think that there needs to be a lot more support than what we are seeing now. And I have a few ideas in terms of, you know, projects that I would like love to work on one day. I just don't feel quite, you know, there enough in terms of, you know, having the skills, the network, and I don't feel competent enough to start working on them currently. But the idea is there, and there's a lot of initiative from my side right now. Yes, definitely. If the government doesn't do anything, then the society should. What needs to happen, though, is just to eradicate the stigma. And again, this should start from individuals. The society itself should change their mindset towards those people who have fought in the conflict before, and try to accept them back and to help them, because that's the only way to really sustainable peace.
Very true. Very true. Let's go back to your very poignant article about a city that vacillates, Bogota, Colombia. You really explore, you know, the tourism, then you look at the social criticism across the graffiti. You've got a proper feel for this city. And I mean, how long were you here for?
So the first time it was probably about a week, and then the second time I was traveling around. But when I visited Bogota specifically, it was, yeah, a week. What I do, and I realize it's slightly odd, is I walk a lot. So there was a day when I just ran about, I don't know, 60 kilometers or so of walk. but it was, you know, I like to explore, and I feel that this is the only way to get to know a place better. Just with my camera, and I never had this sort of, you know, feeling of fear. I know that some people are very put away by, you know, the dangerous neighborhoods, and they say, oh, you shouldn't go there, you shouldn't walk in the dark. And I had quite a few people being surprised, why am I outside at like 10 p.m. and what am I doing on the streets of Bogota alone, like blonde and European and with an expensive camera. And I don't quite relate, because how do you get to know people, and how do you get to understand more about how people live? And if you don't really walk around the streets, if you don't go to the, you know, what they call the dodgy neighborhoods, and if you don't really try to talk to locals, proper locals, and if you go there just, you know, with your own bias, you will never understand. And that's what I'm trying to avoid, really. And it was a very rewarding experience, because now I know that I actually have this real connection with this amazing city, and it's so young, it's so vibrant, but it also has its issues. It's a fascinating place to explore.
Yeah, I'm looking at the blog, and I'm looking at the images of the graffitis you got, and many of the same I've taken. But you've got Candelaria, you've got Chapinero, you've got further north. I mean, I can see where they all are, and you've got the Pedagogica and so on. I mean, you've walked a lot then. So when are we to expect the next update on your blog about Colombia? Because I'm sure, you know, it's now been 3 months since the last one. We need some more. We need to fuel our insatiable reading lust.
I am actually working on an article, and I'm very close to publishing now, on compassion and how we need to approach the other side with compassion so that we understand them. And that is very much a win-win situation in every sense. So hopefully it should be published by at the end of next week. And yeah, it basically explores the difference between having compassion and empathy. There's a lot of studies going on around this area as well. But as it links to the Colombian conflict, and hopefully that's helpful. It is very informative for myself, and I found this to be the most rewarding part of writing this blog. I don't really see it as a way to profit or, you know, to get anything out of it. It's more, you know, the rewarding aspect of reaching out to people and researching topics that I love. And so, yeah, it's been a fantastic experience. One day I'd love to develop it a bit further and to make it a platform that helps others. But I'm just on my way just now.
Oh, yes, of course. It's all a process. But so when are you coming back?
Can I say tomorrow? I'd love to. Certainly this year. My ideal way to come back would be just relocate permanently to Colombia. I have spoken with a few friends. We'll see how things go. I am developing my fluency in Spanish. Currently it's quite high, so hopefully by the end of the year I will be completely fluent to business level, and then hopefully I can relocate. I'm just exploring opportunities. Nothing is ever set for me, but yes, in an ideal world it will be by the end of this year.
Wow, amazing, amazing. Well, of course, it's no surprise to those of us who live here. I mean, you know, we go through, I said every week, peaks and troughs, but overwhelming. The experience is incredibly positive, and this country opens its arms and embraces us as if we were one of their own. And, you know, there is something that is incredibly infectious here, you know, in a positive way, of course, but it's an infectious enthusiasm to living here. And if you work honestly and interact and become part of the society, it's one of the most rewarding places to live.
Exactly, yes, very much so. And I've never really been welcomed so nicely, so warmly by people, by locals. And I got to, within a week, I made so many friends, which is absolutely fascinating. Some of them actually visited here in London. And people from all sides in society, people with all sorts of work. It's a wonderful place, and I think there's a lot of potential for Colombia, not just in the sense of, you know, developing the peace, but also I think more and more people will join, more and more people from different countries will see how wonderful this place is, and there's a lot to explore.
Well, okay. Well, once you're back over this time around, we'll definitely get together and have a coffee. We have to, unfortunately, bring this episode 265 of the Colombia Calling podcast to an end. So let me take this moment to say, Jana Shevkirova, I hope I said it right, thank you so much for your time and sharing some very interesting insights into dehumanization, grievances, the individual, and of course your background, unrivaled background on intelligence and international security when it comes to Venezuela and the sort of relationship with Colombia and Russia and so on. Of course, for those of you out there wishing to read the article to which I have referred several times, just check it out. It's on the it's on the landing page of rebelaffairs.com. So, Jana, thank you so much again for your time.
Thank you. It's my pleasure. And I really appreciate what you do. I find the podcast really helpful. So I can't recommend it enough to everybody else.
Thank you so much. And as I say all the time, flattery will get you everywhere. And of course, this has been Colombia Calling. I've been Richard McCall. I hope you've enjoyed this episode 265 and indeed Adrian Alsema's update from Colombia Reports. We'll be back next week with more interesting people talking about themes which affect Colombia, or talking about Colombia, or anything of that sort of nature. Thank you for listening again, and goodbye. La canoa de...
Can-Can. Over 50 years of endless deals. Deals at ShopRite's Can-Can sale. Going on now. You can't miss it.